In the past 2 years, the world's economies have grown increasingly weaker. From Main Street to Wall Street, widespread and unchecked greed has brought all of this about. There are those experts who believe and are proclaiming now that we are in the worst economic situation nationally and perhaps worldwide since the Great Depression. It has affected business of all kind, whether wholesale or retail, or whether consultation, whether it has to do with business information, whatever. It's affected families. Families are kind of pulling in their belts, seeing what they can cut out, seeing how they can cut down. And it will affect churches as well. Widespread economic difficulties have affected our world before, many times, and they will continue to do that as long as we have this world that we live in. It's financially useful to know how nations have successfully dealt with these kinds of events in the past. And the Bible gives us some insights into that. Like in Genesis chapter 41, where it tells us about this slave Joseph, who, because he was able by God's ability to interpret the Pharaoh's dream, was elevated to the post of governor of Egypt and given the responsibility of taking charge of the agriculture of the whole nation of Egypt in order to prepare for a prophesied famine that would hit not just Egypt, but surrounding countries as well. Well, that's helpful to see what they did when they had some advanced knowledge and that they took responsible steps. But more immediately useful for you and I who are Christians is to know how the early church dealt with hard economic times. And thankfully, the New Testament informs us about that. In Acts chapter 11 and in verses 27 through 30, in a passage that seems almost on first pass to be out of place, kind of a downer, if you will, after such an upper in the verses that have preceded it, verses 19 through 26, we're told, as Luke records these things, that during this time, some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them, named Agabus, stood up and, through the Spirit, predicted that a severe famine would spread over the entire Roman world. This happened during the reign of Claudius. The disciples, each according to his ability, decided to provide help for the brothers living in Judea. This they did, sending their gift to the elders by Barnabas and Saul. Now, if this is all that were said about this particular famine that was predicted and that we know came about, if that was all that we knew about how the church responded, that wouldn't be very much, and it really wouldn't be very helpful. But the reality is that most, if not all, of the ministries of Jesus' apostles were during this time of severe economic hardship. And yet, God's work continued at such a pace that enemies of Christianity complained that Christianity had filled the whole Roman world. Now, how did that happen? In a time of severe, widespread famine and economic hardship, the bulk of the apostles' work in spreading the gospel to the world occurred. How could that be? The church's work continued despite economic difficulties because Christians were devoted to one another, to God, and to the spread of the gospel. In a nutshell, that's it. When Paul wrote to the Corinthian Christians in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, he did not apologize for asking them to hold up their commitment to help in God's work in other places. Now, he could have, because after all, it was difficult economic times. Paul didn't say, well, now, brethren, I know that in the past you made this commitment, and I know that we're in tough times now, so if you can't give quite as much, or if you can't give it all, I can sure understand. Paul didn't say that. He didn't release them from their vow that they had made to God. What Paul did is found in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, and there in verses 1 through 5, where he first told them about some Christians in other places who had much less than the Christians in Corinth had, but who had given with exceptional generosity. Paul writes, "And now, brothers, we want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. Out of the most severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able and even beyond their ability, entirely on their own. They urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in this service to the saints. And they did not do as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord and then to us in keeping with God's will." Similarly, when Paul thanked the Philippian Christians for their support of him, he told them in Philippians chapter 4, and in verses 17 through 19, "Not that I am looking for a gift, but I am looking for what may be credited to your account. I have received full payment and even more. I am amply supplied now that I have received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent. They are a fragrant offering, an acceptable sacrifice, pleasing to God. And my God will meet all your needs according to his glorious riches in Christ Jesus." Paul wanted them to know that this was not about him. He talked in the earlier verses about the fact that he learned to live under whatever circumstances. Boy, the word whatever really comes up in Paul's writing in Philippians 4 several times. He was a whatever kind of guy, you know. He just went with the flow. Seems like he could handle whatever came his way. Whatever. Whatever, if it's good times or bad times, whether I have a lot or nothing at all, I'm okay with it. And so Paul wasn't saying here, you know, guys, it's really been tough and I could really use support and I could really use it ongoing. Instead, he says, you know, brethren, I just appreciate the fact that you helped. And I know that however difficult it may have been or however easy it may have been, it really doesn't matter, that God's going to bless your gift because I know the source of it. I know the heart of you. God always provides when we are hopeless with unexpected resources. Wednesday night, as Brent was teaching about prayer, he referred to a little story back in the Old Testament where the servant of a king, or rather of a prophet, came to him and told him that the armies of the enemy had surrounded them. There was no way out. They were surely going to die. And the prophet said, "Go out and look up onto the hills. Those who are for us are greater than those who are against us." And then that prophet prayed as his servant went out and looked, and he saw at the tops of all the hills about was the host of God. A lot of times you and I are kind of like that, aren't we? God's resources are there, but we don't see them. And you know what? We don't have to see them. It's not our job to see them. It's our job to believe that God will provide what we need to do his work. It's our job to believe that God will take care of us if we'll just trust in him. It's our job to have faith in God, to be who God is. And God is ever faithful, filled with faith toward us. There's another story, though. It's found in 1 Kings, in chapter 17. It's another small story. 1 Kings chapter 17, verses 7 through 16. And it tells another one of these stories of God providing resources that are not immediately discernible. It says sometime later, after, and this is in a time when Elijah had called about by God's leading, a famine throughout the land of Israel. It lasted for 3.5 years, we're told in James chapter 5. It says sometimes later that the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him, "Go at once to Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. I have commanded a widow in that place to supply you with food." So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, "Would you bring me a little water in a jar so I may have a drink?" As she was going to get it, he called, "And bring me, please, a piece of bread." "As surely as the Lord your God lives," she replied, "I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son that we may eat it and die." Elijah said to her, "Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you've said. But first, make a small cake of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me. And then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord gives rain on the land." She went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. It's easy, isn't it, for you and I to rationalize those events. We may say, well, that was at a time when God worked miraculously. Or we may say, well, if we think about the first century and how God provided for them then, God was making things possible in order to show his power to the world and to emphasize that Jesus was, in fact, the way, the truth, and the life. Or we may say simply and without a whole lot of discernment, well, that was then and this is now and things are different. Are they? Are they really different? Just how are they different? How can things be different if, as God says of himself in Malachi 3:6, "I, the Lord, do not change"? How can things be different if, as James chapter 1 and verse 17 says, "Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows"? I would submit to us, folks, that what changes are our expectations of God as we're influenced by our world. Events in the business world do not affect God's power to achieve his work, do they? The Bible shows God bringing victory when there's no reason to hope for victory. When Hezekiah's Jerusalem was surrounded by the army of Assyria, 175,000 men. One city surrounded by more men than we have in the whole country of Iraq and Afghanistan combined. And Hezekiah went to God in prayer, hoping against all hope. And the next morning when they got up, the army of Assyria was dead. God always provides when we are hopeless with unexpected resources. We must not model the church's organization and work after that of some kind of business model or the business world at all. There are certain similarities of business and Christ Church. Both are made up of groups of people, and those groups of people are organized. They have rules of some kind to follow, whether it has to do with the things we believe about godliness in the church or certain rules that are applied by law in the business setting. Both church and businesses have purposes to accomplish and work to do. And yes, both require money in order to do their work to one extent or another. But the church is not organized in Scripture as a business, and we would do well to remember that. Instead, the church is a body, with each member contributing spiritual gifts to the church's welfare and to the welfare of the community. Again, in 2 Corinthians, there in chapter 8, and in verses 13 on through verse 15, as Paul talks to the Corinthian Christians about this gift he's asking them to give, he says, "Our desire is not that others might be relieved while you are hard-pressed, but that there might be equality. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn, their plenty will supply what you need. Then there will be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little." And so there's a concern here about doing the right thing from God's standpoint. And so while there are certain similarities in terms of an outward appearance and even inward action, there are crucial differences between business and Christ's church. Business runs on fears of all kinds, the fears of competition, the fears of costs, the fears of a takeover, the fears of the economy, the fears that someone will make a better product than theirs, the fears that their product will go entirely out of vogue, the fears that they cannot find the right kind of people in order to fulfill their business goals. But the church doesn't run on fear. The church runs on faith in God. Business has organizational charts. It'll tell you who's at the top, who's at the middle, who's at the bottom, and everywhere else. But the church doesn't have an organizational chart that looks anything like that in corporate America. Instead, the church has a gift chart that talks about spiritual gifts and the responsibilities that come out of them that are relational within the body to make the body, the church, function internally and externally. Business depends on human wisdom, while the church depends on God's wisdom. Think about 1 Corinthians chapter 1, beginning in verse 26. When Paul is first addressing the church in Corinth, this church so influenced by Greek and Roman thinking and having so much pride in human wisdom and philosophy. And he says, "Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God. That is, our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let him who boasts, boast in the Lord." Business hires and fires people on the basis of their job performance, while a church nurtures people toward ever greater godly perfection. Business looks to its own resources. How much money do we have? How much opportunity do we have? How much money do we have? How many connections do we have? How much do we have? But the church looks to God's resources. And you know, there's a passage in the Psalms that says something that we ought never forget. It talks about the fact that God owns the cattle on a thousand hills. Something that we're going to think a lot about Sunday mornings during November is our responsibility to God during the time that we're here. You know, Jesus gave a lot of parables about stewards or managers, a more current term that we use. And when you stop and think about it from simply a logical standpoint, don't we all know that it's true that that's all we are? We're managers of the things placed within our care. We didn't bring any of it into this world with us, and we're not going to take any out of this world with us. It's ours to use and to manage while we're here, whatever it is. God has resources that he makes available to us. Maybe what we need to do is ask more and trust more. Business leaders, our business exists only by human ability. But God's church exists by God's ability. Business leaders are chosen for their business ability. And some are extremely well paid for it, aren't they? So well paid that we think it's obscene. But through prayer and fasting of the congregation, church leaders are chosen for their spiritual maturity. You know, when we look carefully at what is said in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and in Titus chapter 1, we'll be hard-pressed to find anything in those chapters that talk to us about the kinds of qualifications and qualities, human characteristics, that elders and deacons are to have that have anything to do with the business world. They have a great deal to do with the spiritual world. Now, we can't ignore the economic realities of this or any time, and we cannot act unwisely. But our wise actions must be based upon God's wisdom and our faith in him to provide for us, for his work, in what may appear to be the worst of times. After all, that was the environment of the early church in the first century. The worst of times, they thought. And yet look at what God did in the worst of times. We cannot forget that Christians live by faith in God and not by sight. I want you to consider these assurances from King David. In Psalm chapter 34 and verses 9 and 10, he said, "Fear the Lord, you saints, for those who fear him lack nothing. The lions may grow weak and hungry, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing." In chapter 37, in verses 18 and 19, he says, "The days of the blameless, the righteous, we might say, are known to the Lord, and their inheritance will endure forever. In times of disaster, they will not wither. In days of famine, they will enjoy plenty." And then in verse 25 of that chapter, David says, "I was young, and now I am old. Yet I have never seen the righteous forsaken or their children begging bread." With such assurances, faith-filled churches are moving forward to do God's work. Leadership Network recently ran their biannual survey of churches, and they found these things despite the economy. They found that 30% of the responding churches said that they are planning for a capital fund drive for new property or new building in 2009. 30%. They found that 25% of responding churches said that they will conduct a fund drive for the poor or needy in their community in 2009. They found that 23% plan to build new congregations in 2009. And despite the economic decline, 74% expect their income as a church will increase next year. 26% anticipate moderate and significant increases in spending on facilities, as well as other things. 52%, over half, anticipate adding 1 to 4 new staff members to their congregation. Scott Wilson, who's a minister in Texas, made this comment. He says, "Make decisions as a church that makes sense for the long term, not just the short term, which is the greater efficiency. Don't go for the easy way when God may be wanting you to grow up in the lean times to actually become more lean and stronger in the end. In other words, don't base all of how you think as a body of God's people upon the economic situation of the time. That changes. God doesn't. The treasuries of a church may go up and down. The resources of God never change. From business or human wisdom point of view, all that these churches are planning may seem to be unwise. But from a faith in God point of view, it all sounds like Christians who are continuing to do God's work in full faith. It also sounds like people who are determined to sacrifice for the work of God's kingdom if that's what has to be. In Matthew chapter 6 and verses 19 through 34, Jesus called for godly people to put their treasures in heaven and not on earth. He called for them to be mastered by God and not by money. He called for them to trust God to provide and for them to devote themselves to Him. I want to suggest to us folks that only people who truly know and truly believe in the God of the Bible will do that. The question that you and I have to ask ourselves is, am I such a person? Will I be such a person? Will I truly believe in the God of the Bible and follow Him no matter what? Will I truly trust Him to provide whatever is needed for me to survive and for His work to thrive? If that's something you've been struggling with and you need the prayers of the congregation, or if we can help in any other way, we encourage you to come forward right now as we stand and sing this song.